Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome. Whoever would like to go next?
My name's Rob Lee. When the gasoline tanker truck crashed into the rail tank cars last December, just imagine how the first firefighters on the scene felt when they saw that the numbers on the eight tank cars on the siding indicated asphalt instead of Bakken oil or ethanol. As it happened, the gasoline fire burned itself out after hours instead of having tank cars exploding right next to a giant liquefied natural gas tank in a chemical plant with its tanks of liquefied hydrogen. Now imagine how city leaders would feel explaining how the city of Portland allowed so many exceptionally dangerous components to exist so close together, and how we could only watch as the ensuing chain reaction of catastrophic fire made its way along the river. Can't happen? Let me remind you that this was one of three recent tank fires, rail tank fires in our area. Obviously, adding any new infrastructure to this ridiculously dangerous situation is a fool's errand. It's long since time to begin moving the tank farms to safer places, not adding to a situation that might explode even before the earthquake. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Deborah Romarin. Nope, it's not dead yet. Contrary to some recent reports, Australia's Great Barrier Reef has not been completely snuffed out, not yet. Only a quarter of the world's largest reef has been killed off this year, and the rest is in mortal danger. There have been three mass bleaching events recorded on the reef, and all of them have happened since 1998. But this last episode, this year was unprecedented. It was an unprecedented die-off. It's the worst scientists have ever seen. How many dead canaries does this equate to? I recently got back from Hawaii, and it's happening there too. Wide swaths of coral colonies have died off. And the reach of this devastation is global. Primary reason? Warming ocean temperatures. Dominant driver? The burning of fossil fuels. ExxonMobil's senior scientist, James Black, way back 40 years ago, he knew it too, and he said the most likely manner in which mankind is influencing the global climate is through carbon dioxide released from the burning of fossil fuels. All of us here, we know what we have to do. We have to reduce our dependence on all fossil fuels and make the move to renewables happen fast. We all know this. You here have done something so important, something that really counts, when you voted unanimously last year for a full ban on any fossil fuel infrastructure expansion. You were clear, you were unequivocal, you were resolute. Now is no time for half measures, watered down inserted clauses, backpedaling, concessions to strong arming forces. Now is the time to show others what inspired leadership looks like. Bold action is contagious. Let's chart a course for other cities to follow. You all make me so proud to be from Portland, and I just want to leave you with one question. When I do my seismic upgrades on my apartment building, will I be allowed through a code or zoning change to build 10 or 20% or 30% more rentable space to recoup my seismic upgrade costs? Of course not, but I still should do the right thing, right? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Next three are Dr. Theodora Tsongas, Julie Chapman, and Mary Vogel, and they'll be followed by Rose Christofferson, MD, PhD, Regna Merritt, and Anna Turner. That's 28, 29, and 30.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Theodora Tsongas. I'm a member of the Environmental Health Working Group of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and a member of the Multnomah County Local Emergency Planning Committee. The fossil fuel terminal zoning code changes recommended by the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission are well thought out. I commend their restriction of aggregation of small fossil fuel terminals. And their rejection of a request by Northwest Natural to exempt its facilities. But the recommended code changes still raise concerns about public safety and could pose a threat to our community and neighborhoods. You've been reminded of the fire that resulted from a collision of an oil tanker truck with an oil train. Unfortunately, the truck driver was killed. Fortunately, the train cars burned but did not explode. It was a very close call for nearby industries, workers, and residents in Northwest Portland. In Mosier, the derailed train cars burned for days and disabled much of the town's water infrastructure, exposing residents and visitors to noxious smoke, as well as causing major disruption in the life of the town. Accidents do happen. Let's not increase the likelihood of an oil fire. We need to truly actively oppose expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure. This means actively discouraging increases in demand for fossil fuel unit trains in Portland. A 10% across-the-board increase in terminal capacity for the 10 large oil facilities listed by PSC would result in additional storage of 39 million gallons of oil, a volume equivalent to roughly 13 unit trains of explosive Bakken crude oil. We must find ways to require seismic and safety upgrades without increasing capacity, or we defeat the purpose of Council Resolutions 37168 and 37164 and the Climate Action Plan. Let's truly take the lead in combating climate disruption. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi. I'm Julie Chapman with the League of Women Voters of Portland. Any increase in fossil fuel infrastructure is not consistent with the League of Women Voters' natural resources and climate change positions. Having followed the process of code development, I've observed that the recommendations have ranged from unlimited expansion to no increase in capacity in the existing terminals. Last month, three of the seven Planning and Sustainability Commissioners voted not to allow an increase. The petroleum industry has not exactly rushed to upgrade their tanks, even with no size restrictions. Allowing a 10% increase in capacity for existing terminals is arbitrary. Any increase in terminal capacity is not compatible with state climate goals, nor with Portland's Climate Action Plan. These goals do not state the exception unless we have an increase in regional population. In fact, regional population increases are assumed in the calculations. The goals are a reflection of the important task before us to leave behind the business-as-usual paradigm and to adopt clean energy policy. The good news is that the costs for developing alternative energy resources are coming down all the time. We live in a state without a petroleum extraction industry and with a wealth of water, sun, and wind. If any region in the world is well suited to shift onto renewable energy, it's Portland and Oregon. We urge you to exercise foresight and to stick to the goals you've adopted in the Resolution 37168. If cities lead, we'd like to be headed in the right direction.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to see you again today. I'm Mary Vogel. As you know, I'm a planning consultant who usually focuses on central city planning, but today I want to support the general direction of these zoning amendments. I do want to question, however, the need to allow the 10% expansion of tanks in the proposal. I know that our planning director, Susan Anderson, knows that urban design and urban form are critical to reducing demand, but Susan didn't mention the residential infill project that we heard yesterday that will allow more people to live in walkable neighborhoods as well as make more neighborhoods walkable. By the way, folks, you can still testify on that or send testimony until November 16th. She didn't mention your upcoming hearing on parking code reform, which was, in fact, mentioned by Commissioner Novick, that will also reduce the demand for fossil fuels. And she didn't mention the Central City 2035 plan that I'm still hoping will make our Central City streets more walkable and bikeable, And there are so many other policies either recently passed or under consideration that will lead to a decrease in demand. So as excellent as the report from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is, I certainly learned a lot from it. It does not make a good case for the need for the 10% capacity increase. I want to support what so many others before me have said and ask you to take the allowance for the 10% expansion out. I also want to support the invitations from Commissioner Fritz and Novick to all of us to come to both the legislative hearings, if you could repeat the date, perhaps, Amanda, and the parking reform hearings as well. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. You know, I want to make a suggestion in terms of process. I know we have more people to hear, but I'd like to call the staff back up for a bit of a work session on just some of the questions that have been raised, because you and others have raised this 10% issue, and we actually also heard from the industry about that. So if that would suit the council, I know we're going to lose a quorum at 5, and we also have some demonstrations downtown that has the police bureau urging people to make travel plans a little differently. So if we can, I'd like to take a little bit of a pause in testimony and just bear down a little bit on a couple of the issues that we've heard. So I think this is certainly my perspective. I think it's the perspective of this council. I know it is. And I really know it is when it comes to you as professionals. There's no one here who's beholden to the fossil fuel industry. My only interest in any mitigating factors in our turning policy into code is to make it work as a practical matter, to avoid getting overturned by some other government. So those are probably the only reasons. So if the 10% threshold, which we intended for reasons of encouraging seismic upgrades, apparently isn't going to do that, what's the case for it?
Let me toss out something and let you guys add. I think you can recommend 0%, but there is an issue around blending that's very real in terms of a consideration, in terms of wanting to be able to have tanks to be able to do that, and whether you be able to monitor that is unlikely. I think adding on an amendment that directs my fellow bureau directors at BDS, PBM, and FIRE to pursue new code so that you can actually require seismic upgrade is, from my perspective, absolutely something we need to do and get moving on. The sooner we do it, it's going to take years, though. So whether or not you want to go to zero now, eventually when you want to go to zero, and if you want to do that after the new code is finally through the state and we get to adopt it, or if you want to do it now.
Why does it take years to get a change at the state?
I'm not going to say that it absolutely will, but in general, the building code changes follow practice, and it's in the past been like a 2 or 3 year process to get a major change in the building code. So you can get Paul Scarlett in here to talk more about that, but it's not an overnight thing. But
well, I would imagine a lot of building code things are kind of insider baseball or there's committees that deal with that. This is obviously a bigger public purpose. So surely if the legislature was to direct it, that could happen faster, right?
So, yeah, I'm really struggling with, I need some, not that you're arguing for it. You tried to craft good policy here, and you also have a history of crafting visionary policy. So, again, it's not like Portland to pull its punches on these issues. But if the 10% threshold, and we just heard from Kinder Morgan, isn't going to incent them to make the change. And if the rate of change from old dangerous tanks to new seismically resilient ones is glacial, it's going to take us 300 years at the current rate to have it all taken care of. So in other words, we're not solving the problem or even ameliorating the concern in the industry, I'm starting to wonder if there's any real upside to the 10% threshold.
Maybe Michael can talk about blending and whether that's a real issue.
That I probably need to hear a little bit about.
Yeah, so I think blending is the consideration. So the state clean fuels program first came into effect January of this year. So it's coming up on being in place for 1 year. It ratchets up the percent of low carbon fuels that need to be blended in.
Right.
So the recent new tanks that we've seen have been specifically for blending. I think it's believable that the current infrastructure will need some additional tanks in order to do that blending as the clean fuels.
But couldn't we specifically address that issue? Couldn't, in other words, if there's any exception or carve out here, couldn't it be if it's only for that purpose as opposed to some sort of general wiggle room?
I think we could try to define it that way.
But presumably any new blending process would have to involve new construction. So if the companies are feeling like, well, being told that they've got to move to that, they're going to be building new tanks anyway, right? So why would they need a bigger tank than currently?
I think that might be a good question for the terminal operators.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is one that, I know we've talked about it before, but based on what we've heard from the community and from the industry, I think it needs work in that sense, in that we want to make sure we're really in concert with the state. We have a state clean fuels policy that I think we all agree is going in the right direction, saying use more and more and more clean fuels. We certainly want the infrastructure of providing those clean fuels to be provided, granted the fact that we're going to be using less and less fossil fuel overall, right? So those are all the scenarios that I believe we agree with state government on. And then we got to get these old dangerous tanks replaced with new ones. It sounds like, frankly, the only way to get to that is a mandate. I'm fine with that. And it sounds like, again, it's not going to happen with incentives. A few people have built new tanks, but, again, we just heard that the 10% threshold isn't going to change their corporate decision-making about that. So, you know, I'm really, frankly, struggling with what we're getting for the 10% allowance. Really, given the testimony that we heard from the industry, it's like, okay, it isn't going to work, then, you know, we're not doing anyone any favors here. Not that we were trying to, but
And also, Matt, just thinking through the politics of it, sometimes, for instance, on sick leave, when Portland has a very strong ordinance, the legislation sometimes comes back and weakens it a bit.
Yeah.
But I don't know why we wouldn't go for the strong ordinance in the first place.
Well, right. And again, as I said earlier, the only reasons I would pull my punches on this issue politically would be that if we had a significant fear that the legislature would overrule our ability to do what we're doing. That has happened. It has not happened lately. The legislature's been going in the right direction lately. They set us free from a prohibition on inclusionary housing, for example, rather than tying us down with new ones. For the legislature to step in, sorry if I think out loud here a little bit, but for the legislature to step in on local zoning would be a pretty big overreach. But I guess they've done that before, too.
That's what inclusionary housing, the ban was all about.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think we've been pretty consistent in not legislating exclusively against the fear that someone is going to pull the rug out from under us,
even though
they have that right, but they then have to make that case. I think as I listen to this discussion, Susan, with the mayor and the incentive plan, I appreciate that Kinder Morgan came in and staked a position. I guess I don't have enough information about who else might actually take advantage of the incentive and what is, as the mayor said, the benefit. If we can't mandate it and we don't control the timeline for that process, although I'd like to see it, the same way that we've moved towards green roofs as being part of a mandate and not just an incentive. And if we're not sure whether the incentive is going to work, i.e. people may not take advantage of it, well, a dormant incentive doesn't have much of a negative impact. But if there is someone who might use the incentive to create what we consider a public good, which is bringing something up to seismic standards that we don't have another tool to do, I guess I'd like to know beyond just Kinder Morgan who might take advantage of that and why, and then before we just say that we're going to take this out, address the mayor's question about can it be tailored so that it's actually adapted to real-world situations where we get a clear public benefit and not just be an invitation to be used willy-nilly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think, you know, in other issues like this, often we've done sort of a do this until, so we could say we will set up a 10%, you know, this incentive until the legislation gets passed, at which time it's going to be regulatory, and obviously it ends at the time. It just covers a...
That would be a disincentive, though, to the industry to not oppose the legislation.
I don't want to extrapolate off of one person's testimony about what Kinder Morgan will or will not do.
Right.
And that Commissioner Novick is not here, but he would be leading the discussion about moving towards upgrading seismic standards. And at least at this point, we don't know whether the legislature will or not take this up in a timely manner. And given the investment we're about to make in Superfund and some early action, we got to get a handle on this because everything we do in the river could be undone if there's a seismic event and we have failure around these tanks. So for me to make this decision, I'd have to have a better sense about who is impacted, who might take advantage of it, what is the public benefit, because right now I feel like we're speculating. And then, yes, of course, it would have to be tailored so that it either sunset or there was some clear oversight about how it was used, and then we'd have some follow-up decision-making. But I think the mayor hit the nail on the head. I just don't feel like I have enough information to evaluate whether it would be an incentive that someone would take advantage of for the public benefit.
I mean, one of the things, and then Michael, take over, is there's no – we aren't setting this up right now. They have that incentive right
now. That's what I was just going to say.
They can do it right now, and we're getting one a year maybe. And so whether or not, you know, there's no limit. They can go 30% over at this point, and it's not an incentive to do it now. So I kind of believe what the mayor was suggesting.
Yeah, I think making it clear, taking it out.
You're kind of believing the mayor should withdraw his amendment?
No,
I don't have that.
What I'm saying is that...
That amendment didn't do that. It's already in the base proposal from the Planning and Sustainability Commission. 10%.
The 10%, but if we're following, we put that in there because the Planning and Sustainability Commission felt like they thought that an incentive would help to move the market.
I appreciate
that. At the same time, there were others on the commission making the case, well, they have that right now,
right,
and it doesn't cause action.
Yeah.
They have what right now?
They can grow it.
They
can expand today more than
10%. In an industrial zone today, you can just go build a tank, right?
There's
no limits at all.
You're saying they're playing Russian roulette?
Well, no,
they're not making the investment to make them seismically resilient because they're not required to, and because you just...
Well,
just...
there's another issue, too, which is maybe they don't see the market expanding.
Right, right.
So as we've drawn over and over and said, demand is flat and or falling, and if we are going to reach our 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, it's only going to be falling. So what would be the private financial incentive for them to invest in this? Forget our rules at all.
In a land use, if we were doing the comp plan right now, you'd hand us a little one-pager that had a bunch of options and a box we could check. So because it's getting late, we've been in lots of hearings lately, could you just walk us through what you think are the options before council on this point?
Leave it in as 10%. That's one.
Yeah, you leave it as 10%. You could go to zero. You could go to something in between. You should also probably have an amendment that says, and maybe you've already put this together, about having BDS and PBEM and fire
put together. Fourth amendment that you have.
You know, the new code. So I think that's it.
So I will say that...
Couldn't you also go up?
Above 10%?
Yeah, you could say 30%.
If 10% isn't sufficient, you know, maybe a 50% incentive is.
Yeah.
And what's the trade-off?
Well, then we don't have really a policy of limiting...
I'd rather have a seismically safe tank or a slightly larger tank. I don't know.
I will say the mayor's Fourth Amendment that provides additional direction has us reporting back to you in 3 years to see what's going on, what the fuel demand trends are, what the tank replacement has been. So that's an opportunity and a check step at that point to review what are the dynamics. I think in addition... The 10% is in there not only for an incentive for seismic upgrades, but the uncertainty around this fuel blending for the clean fuel standards that is in year one and is going to ratchet up over the next 10 years. We don't know what the needs are going to be for a blended tank. We have said it's okay to have a tank of non-fossil fuel, of ethanol, that you need to blend. But that part of that additional expansion capacity is for that fuel blending when you take the ethanol and the petroleum and mix it together, which happens on this end of the pipe, not up in the Puget Sound area.
Yeah. So let me make a suggestion, and that is, again, we don't always do this to go into work session during a hearing, but there's been a lot of consistency about the testimony, and we're gonna lose a quorum in half an hour. Let me restate what I said earlier. Actually, I think there are three reasons that I would in any way weaken what we put in policy into code. One would be practicality. It's got to actually work in the present day. Present day is how we live now, but we're moving towards a lower carbon future. That's our stated commitment as a city. That's where we're headed. So it's got to actually work tomorrow morning. Thus, for example, the asphalt amendment, because oil locked up in pavement is not a problem for the climate, as at least nowhere near as much of one as oil being burned. So, and we do still need pavement. So I'm okay with that one. That's being practical. Second, I want to be political in the sense that I do not want to set the city of Portland up to be overturned in court or at the legislature. So that's a real politic reason to be calibrated in what we do. And the third would be that we're not creating a replicable model, because I believe, as a lot of people have said here, that we're going to create a precedent and a template for other cities to follow. And I want them to be able to pick up this ordinance and cross out Portland and put in Eugene or Prineville or anywhere else. And so that's a concern. Seems to me the 10% threshold isn't pivotal to those questions. Doesn't sound like it's needed in the practical world, and that but the blending thing might be. So I'm going to ask that you prepare an amendment that removes the 10% and adds a blending provision. You know, bring that back to us. We're not going to do that on horseback here today, but bring that back to us as an option, because if there's a way to do that, I think there might be an interest on the council in going that direction.
Absolutely.
And I think Commissioner Fish's request is good as well, which is, you know, in the next week or so, before we return to this discussion, it would be good to check that with the industry. We're not going to agree with the industry on this. We already know that. But how would a blending provision work? You get to build a new tank if you're doing it to follow the state's clean fuel guidelines. Tell us how that would work. Sure. It seems to me that's a set of conversations that you ought to have with them as an industry, and then we use to make adjustments to this code proposal. Is that helpful?
We should also, of course, check in with government relations and with our partners in the leaders in the legislature, both of whom are Portland politicians, so that's great. Could you just explain a bit about the 2,000 versus 5,000? I got kind
2 million.
Of... million. No, the 200, is it?
Million. The 2 million gallons versus the 5 million gallons?
No, there's something else in there.
Sorry.
Just about.
Is this in the amendment? Or in the code?
It was in the code, and people. So it was. No, I can't find it.
Yes.
Mayor, while we're looking for that, I think we should just let the folks here know that because of the demonstrations that are planned around this building, we've been advised to give our staffs the opportunity to leave early because they may not be able to get their cars. There may be a disruption of the MAX or bus lines or other things. That's not to be alarmist. That's just to tell people that if they are required to pick up a child at school, get to a medical appointment, get home at a certain time, it may be that the transportation system is impacted around this building. So I would just say, while we're going to continue this hearing, if someone has that concern, they should just make their own judgment.
And our process check here, we're going to continue this hearing till 5, and then we're going to continue the hearing, that is, because we do have people working on amendments, and we certainly probably won't get to everyone who wants to speak today, so we'll do our best.
So, and you're right, so what's the 2 million in the definition of capacity exceeding 2 million gallons? So could you explain... It used to be 5 million gallons, and what is that?
The Planning Commission reduced that, right?
Yes. Yeah. So we had, originally when we started into this process, we were looking at the large Pembina-type facilities, which are 30, 40 million gallons. And through this process and through the discussion process and through the Planning Commission, we got down, before the Planning Commission, it was a 5 million gallon. That covers pretty much all of the major distributors in the Portland Harbor today. There was concern that there would be both some small operators underneath there that might grow up, you know, growing from a million gallons to 4 million gallons, and what that would represent as a increase in fossil fuel infrastructure. And so the Planning Commission recommended, and before you, is to move that threshold down to 2 million gallons. 2 million gallons is roughly the equivalent of one unit train carrying crude oil.
And what about the 2 million? Because we heard testimony saying that we should get rid of that, and I don't quite understand that bit.
I think it has to do with how small do you get, and when you pull in the smaller operators, does that become a burden on essentially local distributors, such as propane companies that bring in rail cars and then distribute even the small bottles of propane around? And do we want to regulate all of those people that may have 100,000 gallons of capacity?
So it is a threshold. It's
the floor.
It's what's defining a bulk facility.
Who and above do we capture?
And so the testimony that we heard was that we should make it even lower.
Right.
And the reason why is not. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. I understand that.
So I'm not sure if I'm ready to, I haven't heard anything yet that would cause me to move it up or down. Certainly wouldn't want to move it up. But one of the things that ought to be in that follow-up plan is, you know, again, what's our intention here? No more bulk fossil fuel terminals in Portland. So we think we know what bulk looks like. The Planning Commission says that's 2 million gallons.
Right.
That may not be right. In other words, where we would really want to draw the line. It may be smaller than that, but that's something we might not figure out in the first version of the ordinance. So I'm less prepared to try to tinker with that than I am with the 10% provision, which apparently isn't, at least gives people the appearance that we're watering down the ordinance, but might not do any good. And that seems to me the worst of both possible worlds.
From the 2 million to weekend in the next week put together, what kinds of companies, real examples of companies in the Portland area that would be affected by that, so the propane companies and some of the smaller firms.
Okay. Any other requests for them before we'll continue the hearing until 5, and then we're going to have to carry it over for those of you who didn't get to speak today, but obviously also to give the staff the chance to come back with some more.
I would like to see some clarifying language that was suggested by the Working Waterfront Coalition to define what is covered by the 10%, if we even stick with the 10%. That it applies to tanks only and not to piping and pumps and things like that.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Other questions for staff?
That's very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Then let's return to the list, please, and we'll keep going as long as we can.
Okay, the next three were 28, 29, and 30. Rose Christofferson, Regna Merritt, and Anna Turner. And they'll be followed by 31, 32, 33, Patricia Bellamy, Diane Wynn, and Andy Harris.
Welcome. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Whoever would like to go first, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Whoever's ready.
Okay. Hi. Thanks a lot for all the good work you guys are doing. I'm Rose Christofferson, and I am going to testify as a representative of the Care of Creation Ministry of Augustana Lutheran Church. God gave us an incredible rainbow Saturday morning. I don't know if you guys saw it, but the thing that I noticed was that the red is on the outside, the long wavelength, and then it goes yellow, orange, et cetera, and the violet is on the inside, the short wavelength. And what actually falls on the earth, of course, is, we call it light because we see it, but it's electromagnetic radiation, which continues into the invisible range on both sides. Heat is the side that goes beyond red. It's a lower wavelength, and that's infrared. And when we see something, say a red scarf, what's happening is the red is reflecting, and that's why you're seeing it, and all the other wavelengths are absorbed. when you see something like a lump of coal, you do see it, so something's being reflected, but for the most part, it's being absorbed. It's black. And when you burn that coal and you get carbon dioxide and it goes up into the atmosphere, now it gathers warmth because the infrared light that hits the Earth and comes back out into the atmosphere is captured by that carbon dioxide. And so that's where the warming comes from. And the fact that it's above us is why they call it a greenhouse gas. So as we burn the fossil fuels, carbon dioxide is released, and it warms the Earth. And so when you see a rainbow again, I think you'll notice the red on the outside, and you'll remember the carbon dioxide absorbing the heat from the longer wavelength. Thank you.
Wow, thank you. That was a teachable moment.
Yeah. You know, if a doctor can explain it and a city council can understand it, it's actually simple physics.
You call that progress. Thank you.
it's really simple.
Thank you very much. Regna, you would like to go next?
Thank you, Mayor Hales and Commissioners. Today I'm testifying on behalf of Power Pass Coal Coalition, which is a huge alliance of health, environmental, business, clean energy, faith, and community groups working to stop coal exports off the West Coast. We deeply support Resolution 37681 and truly want to see full implementation of those protections. This city council has been well ahead of the curve on climate, fossil fuels, coal, and oil. You have been awesome. Yet after today, Tuesday's election, this is a new world. President-elect Trump is as volatile as Bakken oil. Big oil, big oil and big coal have a big vision and very detailed plans for exporting fossil fuels from our West Coast ports. They are emboldened now and are becoming more empowered with each passing day. While we'd hope there'd be an opportunity to improve in protection, say for oil by rail at a federal level, it's more obvious today than ever before that our local and state leadership must protect and sustain us over the next many years. Bold local actions through zoning amendments must be taken to safeguard our lives, health, and safety, and they must be taken to protect our climate. We rely on you. So please modify this proposal to prohibit all expansion of existing fossil fuel terminals, encourage seismic upgrades through state building codes without expansion of capacity, eliminate the threshold for prohibiting new fossil fuel terminals, and also explicitly prohibit bait and switch maneuvers that allow 100% fossil fuels to be stored in tanks that were permitted for clean fuels. This was done in Clatskanie by Global Partners. Also, please maintain that part of this proposal that does not exempt natural gas and its methane from this code. We've got to stay ahead of the game in this new world. This is where the rubber hits the road, and we can protect our own backyards, we can protect those who are most vulnerable, and protect the climate that sustains all of Earth's inhabitants. So we thank you, and future generations will thank you for taking the right action on this.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hello. My name is Dr. Ann Turner, and I'm representing Oregon's Physicians for Social Responsibility. I've spent my entire career working with underserved communities, first at Multnomah County Health Department, and for the last 20 years at Virginia Garcia Memorial Health Center, both as a clinician and as medical director. And we all deeply appreciate your leadership on climate, coal trains, oil trains, and the recent fossil fuel resolution. Today I'm here to ask that you give strong consideration to the issue of environmental justice as you review the proposed zoning amendments before you. It's important that we fully understand the broad and negative impacts that any increase in fossil fuel capacity in Portland may bring to low-income communities and communities of color. Air quality will be degraded by diesel emissions, emergency response times will be delayed, and those loud, startling train horns blowing 24/7 will disrupt sleep, study, and work for those living in those neighborhoods. Serious health impacts from increased hospitalizations for asthma, heart attacks, and cancer may be experienced by those in the neighborhoods as well, exposed to that environmental pollution. So in order to meet the standards of equity and environmental justice and to protect public health for our most vulnerable, please do not permit a 10% expansion in the new fossil fuel terminals and find a comprehensive seismic solution now rather than later and permit no new fossil fuel terminals of any size. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
The next three are Patricia Bellamy, Diane Nguyen, and Andy Harris, 31, 32, 33. And they'll be followed by Myrta Actor, Ryan Rittenhouse, and Maya Jared, 34, 35, 36.
Welcome. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I don't remember who was first, so go ahead, please.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales and council members. My name is Patricia Bellamy. Thank you for the opportunity to offer support for your fully restricting development and expansion of any and all bulk fossil fuel terminals and eliminating the 10% increase in expansion. And to give you a nurse's perspective, I've been a Portland resident for over 30 years and a critical care nurse for over 40. I'm a current member of the American Nurses Association, ANA, which serves over 3,600,000 nurses, and Oregon Nurses Association, ONA, which represents over 10,000 Oregon RNs. ONA has unanimously passed a statewide resolution in support of Oregon's position of no to coal exports. In a letter to Governor Kate Brown, ONA wrote, and I quote, ONA is continuing to work opposing projects that would increase coal transportation in Oregon. As a frontline member of our healthcare system, nurses are concerned about the health and environmental impacts caused by coal. End of quote. Nurses are also acutely aware of the dangers of climate disruption. ANA's national-wide resolution reads, resolved that the American Nurses Association recognizes and publicly acknowledges that the challenges we face as a result of global climate change are unprecedented in human history, it is critical that nurses speak out in a united voice and advocate for changes on both individual and policy levels, period. Climate disruption is real and impacts are being felt. The health and safety hazards from coal, oil, natural gas, or methanol are far too many to list in this brief testimony. The science is clear. Thank you for your groundbreaking work.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Diane Nguyen. I'm a retired public health nurse and worked over 25 years conducting injury prevention research. I was here a year ago when you passed the fossil fuel resolution. What a proud moment it was. Our city leaders had taken a historic and bold step in addressing climate disruption. Today, as you consider the zoning amendments, I urge you to support the modifications recommended by the Power Pass Coal. With my background in public health, I am concerned about explosions and fires that can cause traumatic injuries and death and the release of toxins into the air. An obvious fire risk is the transport of fossil fuels. In the past couple of years, at least 10 oil trains have experienced catastrophic derailments and explosions in North America. We all know about the derailment in Canada that demolished a city and killed 47 people. One way to reduce these risks is to reduce the need for fossil fuel transport. Even a 10% increase in the capacity of large fossil fuel terminals will increase in the number of trains. Oil and other fossil fuel storage tanks are also at risk for fires and explosions. For example, a human error fire in Mississippi in 2006 killed 3 workers after fire traveled from one oil storage tank to another. Less than 1 year ago today, the potential for a fossil fuel tank fire hit too close to home. A tractor trailer carrying fuel struck several train cars near the St. John's Bridge and burst into flames. This occurred approximately 400 feet from an LNG tank. Finally, like others, I cannot conclude without mentioning the election results. We cannot expect the federal government to do anything to address climate disruption and fossil fuels. It will be up to cities and states. I again ask you to take a very bold stand and pass a strong, aggressive fossil fuel policy. Your leadership will serve as a beacon of hope to the rest of the country. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Afternoon. Mayor Hales and commissioners, I'm Andy Harris. I'm a resident of the Overlook neighborhood of North Portland. My home is above the Union Pacific freight yard within the half-mile blast and evacuation zone for oil train derailments. I work at OHSU, but I'm speaking here on behalf of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Portland does need to take bold and prudent action. Building additional fossil fuel terminal capacity, whether it's 10% or otherwise, in a seismically active area is not prudent. Allowing more fossil fuel trains, coal, oil, and gas to pass through Portland is not prudent. Fossil fuels are inherently unsafe, whether being transported, transferred, stored, or shipped. From the Moser experience in June, we know firsthand about the fires and explosions of the flammable Bakken oil. Portland has made a commitment to reduce our impact on global climate change or climate disruption and to transition to renewable energy. To weaken the Council's fossil fuel resolution by allowing additional fossil fuel capacity of 10% and or adding new exemptions is unwise and dangerous. A case in point is natural gas or methane that is 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. Natural gas is extracted from the ground, as you know, by fracking, a method that increases and causes vast quantities of methane to be released into the atmosphere. Thus far, the transition from coal and oil energy to natural gas has been a wash, as far as its impact on climate change. I'm glad that an exemption for natural gas has not been present in the current proposal, and I would urge you not to create one. So just to conclude, as a physician and as a grandfather, I would urge the council to take bold and effective action by putting the health and safety of Portlanders first. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So let's take three more people, and then we'll do a process check about how we're going to continue on. So.
Next three are Myrna Acter, Ryan Rittenhouse, and Maya Jared. That's 35, 36.
Okay. Welcome.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Mukta Akhtar, and I'm a social and climate activist from Bangladesh. Currently, I'm here working with 350 PDX as an international fellow to solidarity on climate justice issue. Bangladesh is one of the most climate vulnerable countries in the world. The developed countries like US are producing the largest amount of greenhouse gases, but contributing countries like Bangladesh, who are contributing almost no greenhouse gases, are the ones paying a lot. Bangladesh is mainly a low elevation country, and the combination of sea level rise and increasingly powerful storms is already contaminating our fresh water with salinity. The effects are dramatic and devastating. Extreme weather events are having major impacts on agriculture, food security, and economic performance of Bangladesh. The scenery is almost the same for the entire South Asia. According to the latest NOAA data, we can expect a 1 meter sea level rise by 2035. This means 35% of Bangladesh's coastal area will submerge under sea water, and 15 to 20 million people is going to turn into climate refugees. It's a huge challenge for our government now, how we resettle them. The effects have already started in your country. For instance, the catastrophic flood in Texas and Louisiana last year, and the coastal erosion in Florida. Please think, what is the race of development when it becomes risk for lives and livelihood? Due to your contribution to greenhouse gases, our future and the next generation is in great risk. Climate change is not an isolated issue. It is a global problem. And to fight against, it needs collaborative approach. The policy you are working towards no new fossil fuel infrastructures is a good start. Still, much more needs to be done to secure our mother group from the devastating climate calamities. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
No, all right, I'll go. My name is Ryan Rittenhouse. I work for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. As you can guess, we're very much concerned with any increase in fossil fuel transportation through the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. As you heard from the mayor of Mosier earlier, there was the disaster earlier this summer where an oil train derailed. As far as oil train disasters go, that was about as good as you could hope for. As she said, the train wasn't moving very fast and the wind wasn't blowing at all, which is very rare for the gorge, especially that time of year. If we have another oil train disaster in the gorge, it will likely be much, much worse than what happened in Mosier. And what happened in Mosier was pretty bad. There's still ground contamination. There's still water contamination from what happened out there. It takes a long time. This is not something that's being exaggerated. And any increase in fossil fuel infrastructure, fossil fuel storage, even this 10% increase, and maybe even that limit on 200 million gallons is too much, because it will mean more oil trains through the gorge, and it will mean that the likelihood of another disaster happening in the gorge goes up. So the other thing about the 10% is we keep talking about that as in terms of calling it an incentive, and I don't know if that's really quite the right word, because an incentive is something that gives them a reason to do something for its own sake. But this, quote, incentive, which feels to me more like a loophole or a handout, more is reliant upon the market of the oil industry for them to make the upgrades themselves. If we are going to do an incentive, let's come up with an incentive that actually encourages them to make the seismic upgrades for its own sake, and that reinforces the spirit of the resolution and the ordinance, which is reducing fossil fuel use and reducing fossil fuel storage capacity in the city. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Dear Commissioners and Mayor Hales, my name is Maya Jared, and I'm staff with 350 PDX. Frankly, I am thrilled to be addressing a governing body that is ready to take action on climate change. At this moment, we cannot look to federal legislators to speed the inevitable transition from fossil fuels to renewable and safe energy. And so I am that much more appreciative right now of the way Portland has taken the bold and inevitable step to facilitate this transition and ban new bulk fossil fuel terminals. I want to talk about the potential for flatline demand and decrease of fuels in Oregon. The Energy Information Administration predicts for Oregon only a 0.7% increase in total crude oil and lease condensate consumption by the year 2040, though that growth is predicted after year 2030. And that's with low incentives for industrial efficiency and high oil prices. So the biggest possible growth for those fuel needs in Oregon predicted by the EIA. In other words, the most generous models for fuel expansion. Other model scenarios predict a decline of 0.4% on the same timeline. Again, these increases are predicted after 2030. Given the current status of changes to the climate, I pose to you the question of whether fuel increases will be called for after 2030. You may not be able to legally demand upgrades under current law for seismic safety. We in this room will demand upgrades of companies for seismic safety. We have made it politically possible for you as our governing body to pass very strong climate action, and I can assure you that the people in this room and watching you from all over Portland will demand the corporations in this city to make seismic upgrades and safety for our people of Portland. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. So, again, let's take a process check here. We appreciate you who testified, and, again, we know we're not going to be able to hear everyone today. But
could I just ask, I'm very much appreciative of our guest from Bangladesh. Did you have other people who've come a long way to testify today?
I think not.
I believe there might be someone here from Haiti.
That's what I was wondering.
I'm not sure he wants to testify.
He wants to testify.
That's fine. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, if you come all that way.
Yes, thank you. That's very important. Yes. Thank you very much. So it's our normal practice when we have more people than time to continue a hearing, and we may want to do that. We also, I know we're going to want to take up discussion of amendments at our next meeting. So what's our window of availability here in terms of upcoming council meetings?
Mayor, the good thing is we have so little on our plate.
Yeah, there's nothing else going on. Yeah.
Well, I don't have a full council until December 7th when everybody's back. And
hang on a second. So you're saying, well, what about next week? I'm sorry.
It's already on the regular agenda for the 16th, but Commissioner Fish is gone next week.
We may not take final action on the next week because we'll be working on amendments and hearing testimony. So we should go ahead and do that, right? But then the question is, when do we have a third window for
December 8th, like Carla?
Oh, no, that's inclusionary zoning for 4 hours.
But if it's just a vote.
Yeah.
We're all going to be celebrating Governor Barbara Roberts' 80th birthday that day, so we've got to make sure that we have a little window.
That's not just the vote, it's the hearing on the 8th.
No, we're just...
No, we're saying we're going to continue... I want to continue this hearing to next week because it's on the calendar for next week anyway. Susan, you might help us out here if you've got any process suggestions, so bear with us, folks, because we want to be able to give you notice about what's next. But this hearing is going to... This issue is back on the council calendar next week, right, Zach?
Yes, okay. And it's the first item on the regular agenda now.
So we will discuss amendments, the ones that are in front of us, and maybe some others, because we've asked staff to prepare some potential additional amendments. We'll take action on the amendments at the beginning of the session, take testimony, see if we got it right, and adopt the amendments, and then we'll set a date for the final vote. So the final vote could be not going to be the 23rd of November. Right? Because we don't have five of us here.
Right.
Okay.
Could we do it on the 8th, just before inclusionary zoning?
We could do it then. Right? All five of us here on the 8th?
If it's just a vote.
Everybody's here on the 7th if it's just a vote.
The 7th doesn't work for me, but we could do it just before the inclusionary housing on the 8th?
That's Commissioner Saltzman's item, if that's okay with him.
We're not cutting into his time. We're just casting a vote.
If it's only the vote. If it's any additional testimony, then I would object.
Yeah, okay. Let's do that. So we'll continue this hearing next week, right? At what time?
It'll be the 16th, roughly 10:45.
Okay. So if you've signed up to speak today and didn't get a chance and you want to speak next week, you'll be first. What we'll do next week is we will have a council discussion on amendments, take action on amendments, and then let you testify and tell us if we got it right or not. Then the final action on the ordinance itself is on the 8th. And that's how it works, that we don't do amendments and final votes on the same day when we're making legislation. Because the zoning code is around for a really long time, which is the whole idea here. So again, I want to thank you all for excellent testimony. Stay in touch with Zach Lanosky in my office for discussions about these issues. Come back next week if you are able. If you can't come back next week and still want to let us know your thoughts on this matter, obviously email each of our offices as you have been doing already. But I really want to thank this community and the excellent testimony we got today. We have a chance here in Portland to make a difference, and you are why. Thank you very much, and we are adjourned until next week. Thank you.